Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 440 of the podcast. And it's Wednesday, 10th of July, 2019, as I record this a little bit early, as I'm actually going in for laser eye surgery tomorrow. After 30 something plus years of glasses and contact lenses, this is pretty exciting. So I'll let you know how that goes next week. So in this episode, I talk to Timothy Chismar, and I loved him. He's very enthusiastic and funny, and he's a multi-passionate creative, someone who combines many pursuits into his business. Now, I love to interview people who are very focused, like Andre Chaperon from last week, and of course, I've had Mark Dawson on the show, who I consider one of the most focused people I know. And I, however, am more like Tim. I'm a polymath, I guess. I'm interested in so many things and I can never just settle on one. That's just my personality. And you have to know yourself, and you can be successful either way, however you define success. So Tim has also taken some really interesting chances and opportunities to meet people who he wanted to meet, and he's put himself in physical places to actually meet those people, and that's helped his career. So he talks about that too, and really putting himself out there. So I found that interesting, and I hope you enjoy that interview. So my personal update for today, I wanted to direct you to the post I just put on the blog. So that's on the 10th of July, 2019. I have just posted my earnings. Well, I didn't post actual figures, but you can pretty much work it out. My book sales income breakdown by vendor, country, format, genre, etc. And my business year runs May to April every year. And then I do reports and thanks to Russell at authorhelp.uk, who has collated all my sales reports from all the different places. Of course, when you're wide, your reporting becomes a lot more difficult. But you can see this post and all the posts from previous years. I've been doing this for a few years now at thecreativepen.com/timeline, which basically includes all my most important posts from many years now of doing this. So a few interesting things to note. Obviously, you can go and read the full breakdown, but I thought my book sales income was down this year. As I've looked at it over the year, I felt like, oh, this is down. I've done some comparison reports. But once I added in audiobook sales, which I report on separately, my book sales revenue, so the income from books, actually was slightly up from last year. But my ebook sales were indeed down, more than made up for by audiobook sales, which have gone up from 8% last year of my revenue to 15% of my revenue this year. Of my book sales revenue was audiobook sales, 22% print, with 63% revenue from ebooks. So that's really interesting, because I know many indie authors make a much higher percentage of their revenue from ebooks. So yes, 63% for me, 22% print, which has dramatically gone up since I've been with Ingram Spark, and also audiobook, 15%. So I just, I did not make $1 million from book sales. And I'm not going to give you specific numbers, but I did make 7 times the average UK author income as reported in a recent All Party Writers Group report, which I linked to in the show notes. And I made 2.5 times the UK national average income from book sales alone. And of course, books are not the only part of my business. So this discussion, this post is only about book sales, book revenue. And I keep saying these different words, but basically sales can be confused as volume. I haven't got a clue what volume of books I've sold anymore, as in the number of units. I only measure revenue, which is the money that comes in. Also wanted to say I spent 20% of my revenue on advertising. So that's actually less than last year, even though I said I was going to spend more on advertising. I didn't, because I get distracted and do other things. But I do intend to ramp up my advertising spend this year to try and get things moving, and have actually taken on someone. I'm working with someone on this, and there will be an interview coming up with him. His name's Michael. He will be on the show along with Russell Blake in a couple of weeks' time, talking about this type of advertising. So yeah, 20% spent on advertising. And again, that's more than some people, less than other people. And as ever, we are not comparing ourselves against each other. We're comparing ourselves against where we were last year, which is why I'm referring back to that. Now, I did want to talk about the most interesting thing. Well, first of all, the audiobook sales continuing to grow. As I said, that's gone up from 8% of my revenue to 15% this year. And audiobook sales continuing to grow across the publishing world. That's been reported everywhere. But also just wanted to make sure that is going wide. So although I'm done royalty splits for most of my fiction, my nonfiction now is mostly I own the rights to that. Obviously, I've started narrating those. But because I'm wide, the Audible percentage is lower, which means I can sell globally. I can sell on these other platforms, Google Play, Storytel, Scribd, library sales, all of that. Oh, yes, just a good point there. Remember, you can get my audiobooks in libraries and ebooks and print if you ask your librarian. So I wanted to say that those audio sales are mainly nonfiction, and that makes sense because, of course, I have this platform for audio, and of course, podcasts sell more audio. And I'm sure many of you have bought my audiobooks, thank you very much, and have also bought audiobooks after you've heard other people on podcasts. So what I have to remember with this is, obviously, I've been doing this for over 10 years. I have a very developed nonfiction audio platform, but my books and travel site, which is now, 3 months old, will hopefully drive fiction book sales and audio sales over the long term. But I am 10 years behind. So you cannot expect to go from, you know, to go from zero to selling tons in a niche unless you've put in the marketing activity. Probably the biggest shift, and I think this is a huge deal. Again, I've been talking about this for years, but something has changed this year. So, and I said this would shift, but last year, my US income was 50%. So 57% of my book sales income came from the US last year. This year, it's only 39%. And that's a huge drop, but it's not a drop in US income so much as growth in all the other countries. So, and I actually sold books, as in I made money in 54 countries this year, not including free downloads, which to me is kind of stunning. So my other biggest markets are the UK, which was 17%, Canada, 12%, Australia, 10%, and new entry, Germany, at 7%. And that is English books, books in English in Germany, 7%, with the other markets being 15% collectively. And also thanks to Jane Steen, who commented that her sales in Germany have also jumped this year for fiction. So I think what's happening in Germany is digital sales are finally starting to take off. For many years, we have all said that Germany is the next obvious market. It is a huge book market. So I think that Germany could overtake Australia and Canada for revenue because it's such a big market, whereas Australia and Canada are pretty small in terms of population. That's what I mean. I mean population. Big countries, smaller population. but yeah, I think, and I was thinking about this, 54 countries sold to in English this year. And it just kind of blows my mind. And I was listening to some traditionally published authors talk on another show, and I realised that being an indie and owning your global rights is a secret weapon because you can take every opportunity to reach more readers. And I feel like this is possibly the most significant difference between indies who own their rights and traditionally published authors who have basically licensed their entire rights. Because many of those authors, even though they might have licensed World English, will not be selling in 190 countries as we are. And there's no way that most traditionally published authors would have sold books in 54 countries this year, because most publishers don't concern themselves with every country. They just have their territories. So UK, if they're British, if they've got a British book deal, or US, maybe US, Canada, if they're American. But as indie authors, we can put our books out there and people can buy them from all over the world. So very excited about that. I also wanted to mention, if you do read German, or if you are a German translator, if you're a German editor, if you read German and are interested, I am going back into translation into German. So essentially, I did a couple of translations in 2014. Now, oh, I'm so early with things. And I hope you all remember that. Remember how early I am with everything. I got into podcasting in 2009 and it took off in 2014. I got into German publishing in 2014 and it looks like it's taking off in 2019. So if I'm, let's say I'm 3 to 5 years early, I also, you know, started self-publishing in, well, I did my first book in 2007. So again, probably it started to take off around 2011. So yeah, so let's say I'm between 3 and 5 years early on most things. Hopefully that will set your mind to rest around the AI stuff that I've been talking about. But anyway, 2014, I tried these translations in German. I also did Spanish, Italian, and French. And French is great. And we're working with Cyril Godefroy, who's fantastic, licensed basically those rights. But German, Italian, and Spanish, I did as a royalty split deal with some translators. We put the books up and it just didn't go anywhere. Then I even licensed some German rights to one of my novels to a publisher. And again, that did not work. And I bought out my translators. I pulled the books and basically stepped away. It was very hard to do. And there clearly wasn't the market. Now, given that 7% of my book sales income was from Germany in English, I feel like it's time to get back into German. So I have some books coming out. They will be nonfiction for a start, but then I'll probably do some fiction as well. Certainly the books that I've had out before. So I would like some help. If you do read German, if you would be a beta reader or an early reviewer for my German books, and you'd be happy, particularly for nonfiction, please email me, joanna@thecreativepen.com, and please put in the note German reader as per your podcast or something, and I'll tell Carly, who does my inbox, to pass it on to me. But very excited about that. So yes, please do let me know if you read German. I should mention again, joanna@thecreativepen.com. So also on other things, I'm cracking on with my audio summer. It feels like a big audio few months. I am currently re-editing and updating Public Speaking for Authors, Creatives and Other Introverts. I recorded some chapters of that yesterday. I'm re-editing Map of Shadows for audio. And then, of course, we'll do Map of Plagues, which is currently with my proofreader. The pre-order is up if you want to try my Map Walker fantasy series. I'm also working on the Audio for Authors course. All of this stuff obviously takes a bit of time because you have to edit, and even when you upload it to the audio publishing stores, it still takes 3 weeks. So we're probably looking at August, September for all of this to be out there, including my course. So on the eye surgery, I just wanted to say, when I was thinking about laser surgery a few months back, so basically what happened is I've been happily wearing contact lenses since I was 19. I've worn glasses since I was 11, 12, you know, puberty hit and I got bad eyes. And then started wearing contact lenses at 19 and then have basically worn contact lenses since then, like 24 years, whatever it's been. So I was fine with that until, so I'm short-sighted, so if I take off my glasses or my lenses, I really can't see very far. My focal length is, you know, maybe 20 to 50 centimetres, something like that. So I can see things that are close, but not things that are far away. But then what happened just before Christmas, and apparently this is just an age thing, I started not being able to see close up as well. So I can't see far away, can't see close up. And I went to the opticians and they said, oh, well, you're going to have to wear bifocals or, you know, you're going, you know, we have to do something because you're basically struggling in both directions. I didn't even think that was possible. But basically then I was like, okay, I'm not going to wear bifocals because I've worn lenses for so long. My self-identity doesn't wear glasses. And I know that's weird, but we all have these weird things. So anyway, I know laser eye surgery has been around for ages. I went on Twitter and asked, and some of you may have been in my responses. Some people said, oh, it was amazing, life-changing, best thing I ever did, just love it. And then other people obviously have their horror stories. But interestingly, most of the horror stories were from people who had heard from other people, whereas most of the good stories were from people who had actually had a procedure. So I just wanted to mention that because I know that many of you are going to put comments or send me emails about it. So please do not send me any horror stories about laser eye surgery. By the time you hear this, I will have already had it. So hopefully I'll be recovering. So I wanted to mention, just because I just share with you my life, but I'm having this TESSA procedure, which is no touch laser. It's very quick. It's less than 45 seconds per eye for my prescription and it has a faster recovery. So I am intending to be back on board next week. So we shall see. But I will let you know. And I feel like, you know, we've talked about life roles and things that happen. And this is entirely elective planned surgery. And in my diary, I have planned time off the computer. But I do understand that these things can be variable. So we shall see. But I feel like this is something I need to do for my longer term health. And then, of course, I can wear glasses for reading or potentially computer work. So there you go. Anyway, just thought I'd mention that. In useful stuff. So this is exciting because I haven't done one of these since last summer, but the wonderful Nick Stevenson is returning to do a live webinar on automating your author marketing with building an email list. Now, Nick is the king of copywriting and split testing and email marketing, and Nick is pretty much a super introvert as well. He doesn't do much live stuff anymore because he does a lot of recordings, and some of you may have even done the webinar that we did last year that I use as a replay on the website. So you might have already done the old version, but Nick is doing a whole new presentation with new material, including lessons learned from doing a lot of ads, which of course ads drive traffic to a book or a website and can supercharge the amount of data you can collect. So I'm really excited about this. You will learn the 3-step process to automate your author marketing and find your first 10,000 readers. I always learn a lot from Nick. He really is amazingly good at copywriting and email marketing. If you subscribe to his email list, you'll know this. His headlines are just fantastic. So come along and learn from Nick. Yes, I am an affiliate of Nick's course, but of course you don't need to buy the course. You can come along, join the free webinar on Tuesday, 23rd of July at 3 p.m. US Eastern, 8 p.m. UK. And that will be a live webinar with new material. You can register to join us live or register to get the replay at thecreativepen.com/23July. So thecreativepen.com/23JULY will be awesome. So thanks for all your emails and tweets and comments this week. I'm still answering comments on the AI stuff. Delise left a really great comment. She says, I am not sure what to say, to be honest. I will embrace it and go for the ride. And I love that comment. Thanks, Delise, because I feel like that actually are the two sides of how many of us feel, which is, oh my goodness, and guess I better get on board. Also, I didn't really mention the second podcast that went out that day with Makoto Tokodome, which about China. And Randy put a comment on it and said, I ended up taking about 20 notes of things to research and read. Wonderful interview with Makoto Tokodome, full of information and intriguing visions of the future, especially valuable as a starting point for anyone wanting to sell their books in China. And again, something I'm super interested in. So thanks for that, Randy. And Suzanne said, I finished reading AI Superpowers feeling really energized, not because none of this scares me, but because it opened to my eyes to the need for storytellers. The coming changes are going to force shifts in our thinking about the world and about ourselves. Humans understand the world via the stories we tell. Perhaps there are so many storytellers now because the world needs us now more than ever. Thanks for that, Suzanne. And indeed, I am not, as I've said many times, I am not worried about our future as creatives if we use the tools that are coming to augment our creative selves. Also on last week's show, Ron Vitali says, I just finished reading the transcript. Of course, and remember there are transcripts on every episode on Attraction Marketing with Andre Chaperon. And I wanted to thank you. You and he have given me a lot to think about and great timing. I just finished reviewing my business plan. And then finally, Heather Sunseri. Hi, Heather, says, absolutely love this episode. Listened to it on my way from Chicago to Portland, Oregon. Gave me a lot to think about around ground zero with email sign up on the Andre podcast. And in fact, I have printed out the transcript of Andre's interview as well, because he gave me a lot to think about. And the problem is, like, you guys get lots of ideas from the podcast, but I do as well. And of course, my list is just as big as yours. So I've printed out Andre's notes and intend to go back through them as well. So today's show is sponsored by my own audiobooks for authors. And if you want to supercharge your creative business, check out How to Market a Book, How to Make a Living with Your Writing, Business for Authors, which I narrated, or The Successful Author Mindset, or many other of my books, including Successful Self-Publishing, coming soon in audio. That is just going through the distribution sites as I speak in early July, so it should be out soon. A lot of my audio is available on lots of different platforms. So Audible, if you have a subscription there, Apple Books, Scribd, for example. I know many people have an audio subscription at Scribd, Google Play. Also places like Storytel, Authors Direct. You can buy audio direct from me and many other audio platforms. And as I mentioned, even at your own library. So you can request my audiobooks at your library. Just ask your librarian to search for Joanna Penn and see what comes up, which should be a win-win scenario because you get audio for free and I get paid. Yay! Please go to thecreativepen.com/audio for all the links to my audiobooks. So this type of ongoing sponsorship pays for the hosting, transcription and editing, but my time in creating the show is sponsored by my wonderful patrons. And I've had lots of comments about the AI show that you appreciate the amount of time I put in the research. And that time is supported by everyone supporting the show on Patreon. Thanks to new patrons, Erica Tucker and Catherine Pope, and of course everyone who's been supporting the show for months or years. You are amazing, and I really do appreciate the Patreon support. It demonstrates you enjoy the show and want it to continue. And you can support the show with just a couple of dollars a month or a couple of coffees a month if you're feeling generous, and you'll get the extra monthly Q&A audio, which I haven't recorded yet as this goes out, but it should. I should be out there, if you get what I mean. I'm about to do it in your past. Gotta love recording things in advance. Okay, you can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, let's get into the interview.
Tim is an award-winning horror author, as well as a short story writer, screenwriter, producer, ghostwriter, and professional speaker. And previously, he worked as an actor and comedian. You really are just amazing, Tim. So I wanted to talk to you because you're the very definition of the multi-hyphen creative idea. So tell us a bit more about your varied career and why you're focusing on books right now.
Well, I always wanted to be a writer. That was the thing when I was 8 years old, a little kid. I really looked up to Bruce Coville and Choose Your Own Adventures. And I loved writing. I always wanted to get into writing. And I hear that over the course of our life, we tend to go back to that thing we wanted to do when we were around eight. Even if we go off on different tangents. That's what I've heard. And it's certainly the case for me, where I put writers on a pedestal, that they had magic, that they could build worlds and tell tales, and you know, just really influence your whole emotions and take you on this ride. And so for me, I always wanted to go back to it. Even as I tried lots of different hats on over the years, I knew that ultimately I wanted to end back on telling stories.
Yeah, well, fantastic. So I want to start by looking at stand-up comedy, which to me is possibly one of the scariest careers in the world. And yet, when I Googled you, it seems like you were pretty successful. I mean, it's not like some people say they were a stand-up comedian, but they actually never were. You seem to actually have a proper career like that. So how has that career helped you with your writing?
Well, I can tell you that, yes, as a stand-up comic and a true professional stand-up comic, I've been asked at the major clubs. I've went on the road. I've done casinos. I've worked with big stars and all that. You're writing your own material. And there is a language for comedy. There's a setup, a punch, a callback, tag, tag, tag. There's the rule of three. There's always land on the funny. There's embracing pauses. There's being in the moment. So there's a whole language. And in particular, the first screenplay that I ever optioned was a comedy screenplay. So being on stage and doing stand-up really pushes you off the ledge to embrace your instincts and to think outside the box creatively, such as when I wrote the very first screenplay with a couple of friends from college. I didn't know enough about the industry of Hollywood to know what not to do. So I was able to break some etiquette rules, and it worked out for me. I went to a comedy club because we had written this comedy script, and one of the easiest ways to get a script actually made is to attach a celebrity to it. So I thought, I know nobody, but I have this script, and it's really funny because I wrote it. So I just showed up at a comedy club with a cardboard cutout, and I waited for Eddie Griffith. Eddie Griffin, he's this black comedian, and I had a sign that said, "Hey, Eddie," and on the backside, "Screenplay for you." And I waited, and some of the people at the comedy club came out, and they're like, you know, "What are you doing? Who is this guy?" And they just thought I was a fan, you know, an overly anxious fan, and I didn't look crazy, so they let me be. And when his limo pulled up and he got out with his entourage, I held up my sign. And he looked at it and was like, "Hey," and I flipped it around, "Screenplay for you." I'm just a guy holding a sign. And he walked over and said, "So what do you got?" And we started talking, and I got his publicist information, and one thing led to another, and they verified us that we had registered with Writers Guild and all this. We were able to attach him to the screenplay and option my very first movie.
Wow. Now that to me takes creativity and, you know, some balls to basically go do that, which is really interesting. We're going to come back to the screenwriting, but I want to just ask you back on the stand-up comedy, because you mentioned a few things there that seem like rules. And I see that a lot of writers have a problem between the rules, say, you know, some of the rules of structure, for example, same with screenplays, same with stand-up, same with novels as such. So how do you combine the rules with your creative side, the kind of the structure you have to have with that little bit of extra?
Well, I'm a big proponent of, once you know the rules and understand the rules, then you can break the rules. So in parallels with writing to stand up, when you're on stage doing stand up, a major booker will see a few things. Okay, when a comedian walks up on stage, a lot of times a comedian will be so in their head thinking about their setup and their jokes and what they want to tell that they're not present in the moment. So they don't move the mic stand. They don't take the mic out and move the mic stand. A comedian, an early comedian who's performed, you know, five times, will take the mic out and not move the stand and perform their set in front of the mic stand because they're only thinking about what they want to say. And they're not aware. That's one of the things that's a red flag to somebody, that this person haven't matured, haven't kicked around in the industry long enough. Another thing is wrapping the cord around their hands. That's a sign of being nervous and not being comfortable on stage. Well, that same token, if you look at somebody like Joe Rogan, who's been at it for a long time, I don't know who the big comedian in England is. I don't know who's the big English comedian.
I don't even do comedy, no. So.
Okay. Monty Python. If Monty Python is on stage, I don't know. If they wrap it around their hands, then they're allowed to, because they've done this long enough. They can break the rules. So the same with in writing. I mean, we can pick up. I've often wanted to go into one of these writer's critique groups and bring a couple of pages of writing from somebody like a Stephen King. And I bet you, if I said, this is my writing, they would all break it apart and say things I needed to change and adjust. But again, once you reach a level, once you know the rules, you can break the rules. So I'm comforted by that. I like to know that there is a box, and then that way I can break out of it.
Yeah, no, fair enough. And then I'm interested because, as I said, I mean, comedy is, and my husband always laughs at me because he enjoys comedy, but my sense of humor is lacking, I think, at some points. And so comedy seems to me the hardest genre to write. And it is well known as being difficult, as in you don't just tell a joke. I mean, that, you know, that is just not, that's not how it's done. So how have you just always naturally been funny, or how have you worked at the craft of comedy for both your screenplays and also for your other writing?
Well, I keep it light. I keep the people around me who are ridiculous and think outside the box. And there's a lot of parallels, because I do a lot of things, but I tend to mostly focus on horror and comedy. And I know that we're going to get to that a little bit later on, but they both come from a very similar place. There's an old saying that in order to make a normal person laugh, you have a man dress up like an old woman and pretend to fall down some steps. But to make a comedian laugh, it has to be a real old woman. Comedians have a real dark side, and we come from, you know, comedy comes from a dark place. And the happiest, smiliest guys on stage they've got some darkness to them. And so it's a way for us to exercise some of those demons. And there's a power in making people laugh, because even if they don't like you, you can make them laugh. I remember growing up, as a poor kid in a crazy neighborhood, and my mother was the crazy person, and so there were some snooty, highfalutin people who would kind of look down their nose at this little rapscallion. But when I could make them laugh, they had no control over that. Even if they didn't like me because of my lineage, I was able to make them laugh, and that was powerful, you know.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. Well, tell us more about how, because, you know, I think a lot of eyebrows are raised at comedy and horror having a lot in common, because, you know, a lot of people don't see that. They feel like two different emotions. You're not meant to laugh at a horror book or a horror film, or are you? So tell us about, you know, how horror and comedy relate, and any tips, I guess.
Well, I met the editor that I work with most often, Edith by Stacy, at a speech about this very big book, Brent Collings. And he feels a lot of the same way that I do, that it's learning to accept parts of yourself. There's a darkness. There's we're working through things. It's a bit of writing as therapy. And instead of running from, I've always felt that it's not the guy in the black hat you have to be worried about. It's the guy in the white hat. It's the person who's all smiley and pretending like life is great. You know, you don't have to worry about a guy like me because I've seen some things and I've been in the trenches and I've worked through it. And I bring that to my characters and I try to give them a full dimension of, you know, we don't get to choose what family we're born into. Both my parents are convicted felons. My mother served time for stabbing someone. My dad was a drug dealer. And I've never gotten a parking ticket. So I looked at that and I said, hey, that's a bad thing. And then I came over here and I just write about it because there's bad things in the world. And you can work through it by surviving at the end of a horrible tragedy or by laughing at it. And they're very similar. There's a lot of emotion, and you know, being able to survive is something worth smiling about.
Well, it's really interesting. Your background there, obviously, there's a lot within that, and you've brought a lot of that to.
I don't see how. I don't know what you. It's, you know, I mean.
But it's. I mean, that's okay. So I guess my question is. One of the biggest issues that I think people have with their writing is bringing in as much honesty as they can without putting themselves, you know, making themselves too vulnerable or necessarily getting sued by the people they've actually written about, which we can get around a bit with fiction. But how do you both protect yourself, but also protect the people that you love while still speaking your truth?
I do a little exercise when I talk for at writers groups and things like that, where I start off by telling everyone to write down that one thing that you don't want anyone to know about you. That one thing you would take with you to the grave, and don't show anyone, just write it down for yourself. And then I pause and I give them a moment, let them write it down, share that moment, and then I move on. And I don't talk about it again until at the end of my, you know, my session, where I remind them to go back to it. And then I say, that thing that you wrote down is what needs to be in your writing. So whatever it is, that's what you have the most emotion about, however you want to approach it, however you want to get to it. And I've had people come up to me and cry at the end of, you know, a talk where, you know, oh, my, I've never heard that before. And I know the first time that I heard that example, it really meant something to me. So I think, you know, even if somebody else doesn't necessarily get it, but as long as you get it through your writing, there are things that we all are dealing with. And it's a great way to work through it by using it in your creativity.
Mm. Yeah, no, that's fantastic. But how did you, I guess, looking back, because I think people are all thinking about that now, and many of us do put that stuff into our writing. So do you...
Do we pause for intermission right now?
Yeah, pause to think of your secret thing. But do you think that's what... Do you turn it one way to become horror and turn it the other way to become comedy?
Sure, but I think that a really nice recipe can have both ingredients, which is what I do in a lot of my projects. You know, take for example my bizarro novel Soul Trader. It is a story about a demon who comes to claim a girl's soul and then decides, well, if I instead of taking it to hell, what if I just swallow it? Well, now she gets what she sold her soul for, and I get to stay on Earth because I have a soul. And heaven and hell freaks out, and, you know, insanity ensues. And so it's horror and it's comedy, and I'm talking about what's good and bad and religion, and, you know, it's a nice little mix of all kinds of stuff. So
yeah, no, that's fantastic. Okay, so I want to ask you about multiple streams of income, because this show, I talk about this all the time. I have multiple streams of income. I don't like just the one thing idea, and you definitely have all these things going on too. So tell us a bit about what your creative business looks like right now, and, you know, where your streams of income come from, because I think you revamped your approach in 2017. So I'd love to hear about what things are like for you now.
Absolutely. And it definitely did. For the majority of my life after college, I spent 13 years working in Hollywood. So I was doing mostly television and screenplays and stand up and acting and stuff like that. But the truth is, I was not happy. And a lot of the people that I surrounded myself with, some of the biggest names that you see in entertainment are not happy. So the guy who just did a movie with Lionsgate, who has $3 million, sits in a mansion miserable. And I was noticing that I was becoming more and more like the people around me, and I didn't like it. So I took a break, and I left Hollywood and went. Let me give you a little example. The guy I was just talking about, he, on top of me doing the writing work, the punch-up work on screenplays and stuff like that, he would also, Joanna, he would pay me to get people, friends, together so that he could take them out for a night on the town because he couldn't relate to people. So he would pay me to get fake friends together. And that's a thing in Hollywood. So they have all the money in the world, but because of that, they're in this insulated little bubble, and they couldn't connect with people. And so I was, you know, I was checking off all the boxes that I would think this should make me happy. I'm working on these big projects and celebrities know me and I'm making money and I'm doing all this. And I was dead inside. So, I went up to the mountains of Idaho and spent a year trying to get in touch with what's really important. What is that thing that you know? Why is the guy who has no money but walks his dog on Sunday happier than the, you know, millionaire in the mansion? So I spent a year just writing, and I took a job working with kids who had anger issues, and I got as far away from Hollywood as I could, and I turned my cell phone off. And at the end of it, I discovered that I love writers and I love creative people and I want to work with them, but not so much the Hollywood thing. So that's why I live in Las Vegas now, because I'm 4 hours away from LA. And I always explain it to people that I'm close enough to the fire to feel the warmth, but not get burned. And when I was in the fire, I was getting burned. And so that changed everything. I launched Spooky Ninja Kitty, my publishing house, and I started repping writer clients and doing more ghostwriting and worked to get outside of my comfort zone and focus on those interests that were more in the book world and less in the film world.
It's so interesting because, you know, I'm just the same as most writers. You know, we all would like the film deal, the TV deal. We would like to be in that world. And yet you've been in that world and you've left that world. But do you still cross over into that world? So you have a little publishing house now. Do you rep your clients with Hollywood? Are you doing screenplays still? Or how are you still tied in there?
Yes, and yes. And the publishing house is named on, I can't be a writer without a cat. So yeah. There's my cat. That is, he's sleeping right now because apparently that's what cats do most of the time. But it is Spooky Ninja Kitty is my publishing house. And some of my clients, I help them to adapt their novels into screenplays. And I do some screenplay work. I'm doing a Woman in Peril screenplay right now for a client. So yeah, there is crossover, and I still help out with drawing the line and helping to advise them properly. But I like the chaos, Joanna. I like staying so busy that I was telling you a little bit ago, depending on who I'm talking to or what group I'm going to, I adjust what I focus on. Because for a lot of people, they're like, how does this all line up? How did he? So he sold a TV show that combined pro wrestling and stand-up comedy, and he did a movie for Full Moon about killer clowns. How does this work? Well, that's what makes me happy. Right now, as I'm doing this interview with you, I'm finishing up the Woman in Peril screenplay. I'm ghostwriting a book for a celebrity. I'm representing PR for my clients, doing client blurbs, writing for First Comics News, and I'm moderating two panels at Days of the Dead right here in Las Vegas. And that's what makes me happy. I like being that busy.
No, I love that. I'm someone who, like you, although I don't think I have as much energy as you do. But, you know, I think having multiple projects makes me happy as well. But it's kind of annoying as well sometimes, because we do see that the most successful authors, so that, you know, to be a name brand author generally means you have to stick to one genre, one type of book, deliver the same experience over and over again to the readers. So, you know, what are your feelings about that? Like, you know, does it even matter? Do we just double down on what makes us happy?
Yeah, that's kind of what I think, because I think it's personality driven. I think, and that's okay. What works for me doesn't have to work for everybody, but I'm personality driven. So I have a name in the pro wrestling world. So we just did this big thing called StarCast. I'm hanging out with all these pro wrestlers doing wrestling stuff. I also do the horror thing. So I'm able to go to horror conventions, the comedy thing, the Comic-Con thing. And because of who I am, I can exist in all of those areas. Now, if somebody isn't as giant a personality as old Fathead over here, then if they hardly ever leave their house and they love writing Westerns, they should at least join a Western writing group, go on some Western writing message boards. They need to interact with people who think the same way that they do, because they're a brand, and that's the brand that they represent. With me, my brand is my personality. So I'm able to break it off into some different facets that wouldn't necessarily line up. I tell some of my clients who have very strict guidelines about what they write not to say that I represent them, because some of the things that I do might not fall into their, you get what I'm saying? So I tell them that ahead of time. So some of the work that I do, I literally don't say, I represent so-and-so and they've got a great book about pottery coming out. I instead say, I have a friend who has this book about pottery, and would you write a blurb for them? Or so I, you know, that I work within those parameters, because I understand that not everybody is as loud and outspoken as this guy. You'd get a kick out of this. One of my clients wanted to write a book. Are you familiar with Chelsea Handler? Do you know who she is?
Not really. No.
Okay. She's a big comedian here in the States. She has a talk show, and she writes some risque books about her personal life. And so this client of mine wanted to do the same thing. She wanted to write a book about her personal life, and she thought it would, you know, be entertaining and all this. Well, she told me that she was going to rent a castle in Ireland to go there and be inspired to write this great book. And I knew what you probably know, that if she can't write it in her, you know, in her office, she's not going to be able to write it in the castle in Ireland. But she went there, spent all this money, got this castle, and stayed there a month and came back, and she had barely forced out a chapter of the book, because it's about mindset. If you can't do it in your head, it doesn't matter what the view looks like outside the window, because it's the view that's inside your mind. So anyway, just want to point that out.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And in fact, I say to people, like, I did the same years and years ago, you know, quit my job in order to make a business, and it didn't work. And in the end, I built this business while having a day job, because you kind of need that structure at the beginning. But I want to come back to, you talk there about, you know, if you do write genre, then joining a genre organization is a really good idea. And you co-founded the Las Vegas chapter of the Horror Writers Association, which I'm also in. And sometimes indie authors feel that organizations, literary organizations, are not that welcoming. So why is the Horror Writers Association important to you, and why should authors get involved in genre organizations?
Well, I think it's important to build your brand with people who are like-minded. And I can use myself as a perfect example. I had a comfort zone that I was comfortable with. It was screenplays. It was punch-up work. It was writing jokes. It was eventually short stories and magazines. What I was not comfortable with was writing a full-length novel. That just, I was just terrified of that. It was too much. Because when it's done, it's done. And I was afraid of that moment where it's like, okay, because it's easier to talk about how great it will be. Oh, I'm working on this thing. It'll be so great. You won't believe how great it is. But when it's done and it's a novel, you're really standing on your own I don't know. That was tough for me. So I say that because when I went to the HWA, I was worried. The first group I went to was in Los Angeles, and I was worried that they were going to be snooty, that they were all going to be pompous librarian types where they look down their nose and they're, you know, oh, you think you want it? Like they all write with, you know, quill pens or something.
Oh, they all British.
Gee, I hope not. Oh my goodness. So I went, and they were very welcoming, very nice. Some of the greatest people I've ever met. And most important, when it comes to business, I sold my first short stories were to people at HWA groups. They ran traditional publishing houses. They were putting together collections, and I was spoiled. I was actually, I got some really nice deals, and I got in some good publications, and it was amazing. And I got to share this one. This sums everything up. Why everyone should run, don't walk, to join their genre meeting group for writing. Here's why. I went to the HWA in LA, and I had sold a couple of short stories. Well, I was talking about my crazy demon novel, and there was a woman who ran a traditional press at the meeting, and at the end of it, she came up to me and she gave me her card and she said, that sounds great. My small press would be interested in possibly putting out your book. And so she gave me her card, and I said, oh, okay. And I put it in my pocket. Now, between you and me, because it's just you and me, there's nobody else listening, right? Just between you and me, I was terrified to put a novel out. So I wasn't ready for it. So, you know, anyway, I took the card. I said, oh, thank you very much. And I blew it off. I did not follow up on it. A couple of months later, I was at the LA Times Festival of Books, this giant book convention in LA, and she approached me again. And I had made some friends and people knew me. And so she asked if she could talk to me again. And she took me aside and she goes, Tim, this is what happened. She goes, Tim, I just want to let you know that I spoke to the people at our press, and we understand that the first time when we offered you that book deal, we insulted you by only offering you a one book deal. So we would now like to offer you a three book deal if you would please consider going with our publishing house. So I had to keep face and your senses. But the truth is, I wasn't comfortable with one book, let alone three. But that's the kind of thing that can happen if you're just friendly and smiley at these publishing places, because you are who you say you are. If you say I am a professional established writer and this is what I do and here's my idea, people will treat you as such.
Yeah, I think, well, one of the things, circling back to your cardboard cutout as well at the beginning, it is just actually sometimes physically being in places with other people is important. And I'm an introvert as much as anyone listening is an introvert. And it is hard, you know, for some personality types to do that. But I agree with you that going to conventions and, you know, it doesn't matter if your personality is not like yours. I mean, you have a very welcoming and wonderful smile. And, you know, I think I could come up to you at a convention and talk to you. Whereas, like, I know I'm scared of other things, but your experiences there just show that you just have to be a person with other people, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Because you never know what they're going through, and grass is always greener, and, you know, people are nervous, and they have things that they're working through as well. And you can connect just by being yourself, just by being honest and open, and, you know, you can connect, and that's important. And it's very hard for you to connect by staying in your living room, because that owner of a traditional publishing house isn't going to come walking through. So you kind of have to go to them.
Yeah, no, I agree. Unless you have a podcast and you get on Skype, which is how I do it. Okay, so you have a chapter in fantastic book, It's Alive, Bringing Your Nightmares to Life, which just won a Bram Stoker, which is very cool. And it's a great book if you want to write horror. Anyone listening, it has lots of great interviews about writing darker stuff. And you interviewed Clive Barker, Master of Horror, which is, well, firstly, incredible that you've got to interview him. But I wonder was there anything that really stood out from that interview? Obviously, people can read the whole thing in the book, but anything that really stood out for you? Oh, and how did you get that interview?
Sure. Thanks for asking. Yeah, I met him years before that. And it's, you know, I hadn't thought about this, but it's a cool thing to share because we've been talking about stepping outside your comfort level. I was in line to get an autograph like all the other fans, and I wanted desperately to make a connection with him because I had read his stuff as a child, a wannabe horror writer, and I just wanted to make a true connection with the man. And so when I got my opportunity to get the book signed, I had three things to say to him prepared in my head that I was going to say that would separate me from everybody else. And it worked. And he asked me to come around to his side of the table. And I sat down next to him and talked to him like a friend while he signed everybody else's books. And that absolutely happened. And at the end of it, he gave me a big hug and gave me his manager's contact information. And it was amazing. And we became friends. And we emailed after that, and we kept in touch. And he gave me some advice on writing. And you know, over the years, I had that connection. And again, that's a cardboard cutout moment because. That I didn't know the man. I literally was like all the other fans in line, but there's a big difference between being a fan who's just like, oh God, thank you, sir, and walking away versus being a peer. And I wanted to let him know that I respected what he did and I wanted to follow in his footsteps. And I, you know, like one of the things I said to him was that I appreciated the fact that he never turned his back on horror. Dean Koontz started the Horror Writers Association and then went to, you know, thrillers. And Anne Rice went to like erotica stuff. And Stephen King does things like The Green Mile. And Clive's never done that. Clive's a horror guy. And I told him that I appreciated stuck with it. And, you know, so that was just one of them. But I had a few things I wanted to separate myself. And anybody can do that. You can meet somebody that you admire. And as long as you talk to them like a human being, like a peer. So anyway, I had that connection. Years later, Crystal Lake Press was putting out, this is the second in a trilogy of books about advice for writers. The first one was about the ideas. The second one was about the actual process. And the third one I think is going to be about like promoting the works and, you know, anyway, so you get the, so they reached out to me because they knew that we were friends and they said, hey, do you think Clive would be interested? Because I hadn't worked with him on anything. So I just reached out and, you know, it worked out. I was able to spend 3 days at his home in Beverly Hills. And we just went through the process and I recorded a lot more audio than I used. I probably have enough for, you know, three more interviews with the guy. And he's just amazing. And the friendship, the encouragement, it meant the world to me, the blurb on my writing. And just, I'll tell you, the biggest thing I got from being able to work with Clive was that we are all human. We all bleed. We all cry. We all get scared. We all laugh. When I was walking through his room of paintings, these giant, huge paintings, there was a pile of dusty old awards, and some of them were falling apart. And they were some of the biggest awards in the industry that we all, you know, hope to achieve. And here they are, you know, dusty in an old table in the back room. And it was kind of cool because we all think about that moment when you accept it on stage. And then what, you know, and then the years roll on. And so it was really cool to see that. I'll tell you what I don't mean this disrespectfully in any way. I felt like in the movie Ed Wood, when Ed was spending time with Bela Lugosi. That's how I felt, like that there was this guy who had been this giant industry force. And here he is, you know, later in life. And, you know, and he's human just like we are. And it was really amazing to, you know, to be at the feet of the master.
Yeah, well, and that just ties in as well. I think we have the theme of this podcast, which really is making an effort. And I think that's what you've shown in this, is that you haven't just gone, oh, I'm going to go and meet Clive or that comedian or whoever. You've actually thought about how you're going to approach things in a way that makes you stand out. And that is the key. And I've learned a lot from you today about that. And I'm going to try and be more brave in that way.
Well, wait. You got this. And you said you're a member of the Horror Writers Association?
I am. And I'll be at StokerCon 2020 because it's in the UK, right?
Okay, that's what I was going to say. I want to see you at StokerCon. Yes. Okay, cool. Good. No,
I will be there. So tell people where they can find you and all your books and everything you do online.
Definitely. You can find me for repping clients and that side of it, the happy smiley stuff, at timchismar.com. And then for the doom and gloom dark stuff, it's at spookyninjakitty.com. You can find me on social media, Tim Chismar. I'm pretty easy to find. You can find me on Amazon. And this is great. I get to mark this off my bucket list. I love the podcast. I'm a huge fan. And thank you so much for letting me be on the show. I do have a bit of advice for writing suspense. A really great tip for doing suspense, if you'd like to hear it.
Okay, give us that.
I'll tell you another time.
Very good. You've been great. Thanks so much, Tim. Bye.
So I hope you enjoyed the interview with Tim today and that it resonated with all the multi-passionate creators out there. Next week, I'm talking about flash fiction and making a living as a writer with Jason Brick. So happy writing and I'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.